Welcome to Power Play. Thanks for joining us. I'm Evan Sullivan. On the program today, Ontario overwhelmed and makes a big reversal.
With COVID spreading like wildfire, with these deadly variants taking hold in Ontario, we simply can't be too cautious right now. We have to be proactive.
Province is shutting down in-school learning only a day after saying in-school learning would remain open after the April break. This as hospitals battle a sharp rise in ICU admissions. Did that province make a mistake last week or yesterday? What caused the sudden change? We're going to get the latest from CTV's Colin DeMello and from a member of the Doug Ford government in a minute. Then pandemic vandalism and riot in Montreal. Check this out.
Acceptable. People are allowed to protest. It's their right. Do it right. Don't attack people that are already suffering.
Window smashed, arson, 7 people arrested, over 100 tickets issued as a riot broke out in the Old Port of Montreal after the curfew was lowered from 9:30 to 8 p.m. on Sunday night. What caused the violence? Where is all this headed? We're going to talk to the parliamentary assistant to the Premier of Quebec, Christopher Skeet, about that. We'll also get the latest. Is more violence coming? Plus, a military investigation shut down?
Why did the Liberal government shut down the Defense Committee investigation that is trying to protect women in the military? What are they trying to hide?
So that is the question. Why did not only the Liberals, but the Bloc vote to shut down the House Defense Committee's investigation into allegations against the former Defense Chief Jonathan Vance, allegation that Vance denies? Who is accountable for all this? We're going to bring MPs from that committee on here to debate. It's an incredibly busy day. This is Power Play. Let's get to those players. So a sudden reversal on schools as Ontario and that government announces in-school learning is now suspended for 2 weeks after the current April holiday break, which is going on right now, ends. All this because the province-wide positivity rate has hit its highest level since December. ICU capacity in that province has reached a critical juncture. Patients in hot zone areas are actually being airlifted to other regions of that province. Still, heads are kind of spinning by all this because today's announcement comes one day after the education minister in Ontario sent a letter to parents saying that in-school learning will actually continue after the break. So why so many changing decisions? Is this adding to confusion about any kind of coherent plan? We begin our coverage with the CTV News Queen's Park Bureau Chief, Colin DeMello. Colin, the Ontario government shutting down schools or in-school learning, what was their rationale for the sudden about face?
Well, you know, typically throughout this pandemic, Evan, they've kind of used a Monday to Friday cycle where they kind of start examining the numbers on Monday and make a final decision by Friday. They say, though, that the variants of concern are spreading so quickly that they had to move at a quicker pace than that. So now as soon as they see the data coming in, that's when they're going to be making those decisions. And the premier and the government is really placing this at the feet of the variants of concern here. They say that, you know, over the course of the weekend, we saw record numbers in terms of new cases in this province, record numbers in terms of the number of people admitted to ICU. And so they're not looking at what has happened in the past, more so they're trying to avoid what could happen in the future. And the concern here is if the community transmission is really high, then that's a higher risk of students tracking the virus or teachers tracking the virus into schools and then causing more outbreaks.
Yeah, fair enough. What's been the reaction, though, both political and to the mixed message? It was Stephen Lecce, the education minister in Ontario, who sent a letter to parents yesterday saying, don't worry, in-school learning is going to stay open. Today, you know, the flip-flop, what's been the reaction to that?
Yeah, you know, this government has been emphatic throughout this entire middle of the second wave coming into now, because even if you think back to January when schools reopened after the second wave, the government said this was going to be the last closure, that their goal and their aim was to have the schools open for the remainder of the school year. I mean, there has been, you know, quite a lot of anger here, because not only are the schools closing for in-person learning, not only are parents frustrated, we've been hearing stories about how, you know, students have basically given up. A lot of them are tired of learning through a screen, but also we don't know what the metrics are to reopen those schools. Remember, this closure is indefinite. We don't know if schools are going to be returning by the end of the school year in June. So this is an indefinite period, and we don't have the exact metrics or the criteria for what it will take to get those students back into the classroom.
Okay, maybe we'll get some details next. Colin DeMello doing superb work as usual at Queen's Park in Ontario on the situation there. Colin, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Let me get some government reaction, because as we said, the move to shut down in-person learning comes just a day after the education minister, Stephen Lecce, sent a letter to parents saying, don't worry, in-school learning is going to resume after the April break. So is this causing confusion? Let's find out. Joining us now is David Pacini. He's the Ontario's parliamentary assistant to the ministers of college and universities. Mr. Pacini, always good to have you on the program. What changed here from Sunday to Monday? Because you got to imagine, I'm a parent with school-age kids, heads are spinning. You're in school, you're not in school. What's going on? Why so many changes?
Well, thanks, Evan. I mean, first off, I'd start by saying, obviously, we understand the very difficult situation that we're in here in Ontario, Canada-wide and globally in fighting the COVID-19 pandemic and specifically the variants of concern. So you asked what's changed. Well, what's changed is over a span of 4 days, we've seen a 22% increase in ICU admissions, a dramatic spike in hospitalizations. I mean, these are some of the concerning trends we're seeing province-wide with respect to the variants of concern that we know are spreading much faster, targeting those at a younger age, and it's very concerning. So consistently, Premier Ford and our government have had to act very decisively. And I think you mentioned earlier, Evan, that the comment with respect to what the minister communicated, and I just would make a point of clarification that letter that the minister sent out was to talk to the investments that the government's making to support them when schools do return. So I understand that people get that letter and they see, you know, here are the investments that the province of Ontario is making to ensure safe schools, and then they see this. But I think you can sympathize that I think it's important for the minister to communicate those measures to instill confidence in parents and to talk about the dramatic investments, but while also the need to act very decisively, as we've done.
But let me talk about decisively, or as the Ontario Premier said today, proactively. This sounds reactive. Let's go back. Dr. Steiny Brown, who's the head of the Ontario Science Advisory Table, at a press conference on February 11th, presented modeling data that he was asked, is this predicting a disaster? And he said, no, you're not mistaken. These are the numbers. Then your government opened shops, you opened schools. This was the disaster everyone saw coming. How is that in any way proactive or decisive when you're opened and closed? When doctors told your government the modeling is clear, the variants are coming, disaster is coming, why pretend to be surprised now?
Well, I don't think we're pretending to be surprised at all. I think what the reality here is that we consistently monitor and work closely with healthcare professionals. And COVID's not linear. Things change. And with the dramatic spike, we had to act decisively. And as I said, we've made significant investments to ensure schools are safe. Dr. Williams has always said, as is the minister, as is the premiers, students will be at schools and will be the last to close and the first to open, because we understand the importance for a continuity of education and for students' mental health. So this was a very difficult decision, but this was not one that was forecasted in the modeling you mentioned. You mentioned modeling, and this province acted very decisively to pull the province-wide emergency brake as we saw the concerns coming. We acted decisively there. We know that the measures will show in a delayed manner. We'll still see likely the Easter break have an effect over the coming days. But we're acting very decisively, Evan, to act proactively to prevent what could happen.
Respectfully, it's been more like a yo-yo. It's been opening and closing, and every time there's opening, we've gone back to more restrictions. I don't want to get in too much in the rearview mirror. Let me try to look through the windshield for a second. What is the metric that your government will use to reopen in-school learning? It's hard to figure out what the metric was to close it, but what is it? How will parents in your province know if their kids can go back to school, and when will they be notified?
Mm-hmm. Well, I just have to address that comment before, and then I will address what you said, the measures going forward. First and foremost, Ontario consistently has had very stringent measures, Evan. I think there's no disputing that. This premier's acted decisively, and these have been very difficult and real decisions that have had an impact on the lives of Ontarians. But it's to protect the integrity of our healthcare system, and we've led with asymptomatic testing. We've led with masks for students. We've led with ventilation improvements. All of these measures point to proactive steps that we've taken as a government that I would add, and you know this, that other provinces have followed suit. To speak to your question,
but to be fair,
about,
I know we're going to get into a back and forth, but sir, you got to admit, your government has loosened restrictions after Steiny Brown warned you to. Then the third wave came exactly as predicted. That is not proactive. You know that. The opposition has said you ignored the modeling. You've got the leader of the Liberals calling for the education minister to resign today. I understand that. But sir, respectfully, you've loosened restrictions in the face of medical and scientific warnings and paid a price for it. Everyone has watched that.
I would say, Evan, respectfully, we have not. We have kept this province and concerned hotspot areas like Toronto in gray lockdown as a part of the provincial response framework that has, you know, kept the engine of our economy and our largest city in Canada with very difficult and real restrictions. You on your show have had many advocates from the chamber and a number of other voices that have called for a loosening of those restrictions. And the premier, despite all that, has maintained decisive action to keep and protect Ontarians. So then as we use the province-wide emergency break, it's been with, again, the constant modeling that's evolving, and we're acting and making very decisive decisions here. It's not easy, Evan, and I don't think there's a crystal ball. I think if we all had it, we would take it. Consistently we've aligned.
I agree, we all agree it's not easy, but that's the job of leadership. So I'm just going to ask you, what's the metric then to reopen? Do you guys have one?
Well, I think we have to look consistently forward at ICU. There's got to be a stabilization in ICU admissions and hospitalizations. We know that over the break, again, this time, we're proactively targeting special ed teachers, because I will add as a caveat that it's important to mention for special ed students, they are maintaining in-person learning. So we're targeting those teachers. And then in phase two of the province's vaccine rollout, we are targeting teachers over this break period to target, as I said, those spec ed teachers and then gradually we'll move towards teachers across this province. But I think you asked what metrics we're looking for. I think across the province, we're going to look for a reduction in ICU admissions and hospitalizations. We're going to need to see, Evan, a really reduction in the positivity rate in the rate of infection across the board in the province of Ontario. And as we said, schools were the last to close. They will be the first to open. So again, this isn't linear. I'd love to be able to give you a precise date, but based on the modeling and based on what we're seeing right now in hospitals, it would be imprudent for me to specify a specific date. Rather, I've pointed to tangible conditions that we would need to see an opening.
All right. Well, we're all obviously, many parents are waiting to see that. David Pacina, good to have you on the program. Ontario's parliamentary assistant. Yeah, a pleasure to have you on. The parliamentary assistant to the ministers of colleges and universities. So that's going on in that province. Let me move east to Quebec, because storefront windows smashed, arson. Check out these visuals. Fire set in garbage cans. Police are investigating after last night's curfew riot in Montreal. Well, it started as a protest and became a riot. Riot police were on the scene. They were firing, look at this, tear gas, 7 people arrested, over 100 tickets given out. What is the aftermath of what happened last night? Where is this headed? Was all this a reaction to the curfew going from 9:30 to 8 or not? Joining me now is CTV National News Montreal Bureau Chief Geneviève Beauchemin. Geneviève, good to have you back on the program. Give us a sense of what happened last night and how a protest descended into a riot.
Evan, it started really kind of peacefully, of course, at 8 o'clock p.m. as the curfew was supposed to come into place in Montreal. That was the return of that curfew, as you said, from 9:30 to 8 p.m. instead. And people in old Montreal just had gathered. There had been word on social media all day that they should gather there to protest against this curfew. A lot of young people there. The chants were about liberty for the young. And then as the night wore on, as police started to mill about the area, some of those people went home, but some stayed behind. And there was rioting in those streets and a lot of looting. And today, when you were walking through the streets of old Montreal, there was glass in so many streets. So many storefront windows had been broken. There was a lot of looting as well. And a lot of shopkeepers who were just despondent as to what happened, saying that, you know, essentially they've been down, that they've been hurt by the measures for so long here. And this is just kicking them again. And so they were just saying that they were shaking their heads about what happened. Look looking at the number of people on the streets, but also the damage that was left behind. They know that, you know, those hundreds of people who were protesting against the curfew weren't, you know, all responsible for what happened. They say, we know it's a small group of people that ended up doing all this damage, but what's left behind here is unfathomable to them. They're really, you know, saying that they've lost a lot of money, but a lot of confidence as well, that this is really, really hard emotionally for them as well.
Yeah. Disgraceful to see businesses suffering, have to deal with this. No one condones it. It's heartbreaking to think what they're going through now after trying to deal with this. But, Jean-Vier, just before I let you go, what was the cause of the protest? I know that the curfew's been lowered, but why are so many people out there protesting that? What is the issue there?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that because you were talking about the yo-yo measures a little bit earlier. A lot of behavioral psychologists were saying exactly that, that after so many months under these measures and these, you know, the measures flip-flopping, the changes switching on and off, which has happened here in Quebec as well, a lot of people are saying, you know, it's just really, really hard for people to understand, to keep going on this. So they're saying that's part of the problem. It's about the curfew, but it's also about frustration with the measures, frustration with the government.
Jean-Vier Beauchemin, CTV Montreal Bureau Chief, great to have you on the program. I want to dig deeper into what Jean-Vier is just telling us. How's the leadership in Quebec responding to the riot last night? Our next guest has called it a disappointing display, to say the least. Quebec MNA and Parliamentary Assistant to the Premier, Christopher Skeet, is here with his view. Good to have you, sir, back on the program, Mr. Skeet. The reaction to those shocking scenes. Like, we all know there's frustration. We get it. The destruction, though, was stunning. What was your reaction?
What strikes me is that these people are claiming that in the name of freedom, in the name of freeing up our restaurants, freeing up our shops, they went ahead and destroyed the very shops that they're protesting for. A disappointing display, yes. And, you know, let's just call it what it is, a disgusting act altogether. Disappointing. On the one side, I get the frustration. On the other side, I get the COVID fatigue. But on the other side, I mean, that's just not the way to go about expressing ourselves in a democracy.
Let's talk about, I mean, it did happen. First of all, I just want to say, I am never going to condone this kind of disgraceful vandalism of honest shopkeepers' work. But people are frustrated and people are protesting. Is your government, when you lower the curfew from 9:30 to 8, there's a lot of people that say that is not what we need right now, that's keeping it at 9:30 seemed at least acceptable. Did your government fail to communicate, again, this is not to justify the vandalism, but to try to understand the protest, fail to communicate properly the need to drop that curfew right now to 8 p.m.
You know, COVID is all about reducing the number of contacts, right? So if in normal times, we have 15 contacts. In COVID times, we got to reduce that as low as possible, 3-4 contacts. And anytime you can drop a contact in your day, you're going to help with the spread of COVID. Now, we're seeing with the variants that are a lot more contagious, a requirement for us to double down and do even more to try and stop this third wave. Now, we determined that one of the best ways, one of the most effective tools was a curfew, and the data is showing that the curfew is helping. And I think what happened is that, you know, it's spring now, the sun is setting a little bit later, people are feeling this one, you know, and they're feeling this one. But at the same time,
that's important, Mr. Skeet, because, you know, when the state infringes on civil liberties, and a curfew is a deep, deep infringement. And there's, and you know, some of the young people are saying it's still light out. 9:30 is one thing, still light out at 8. We don't have backyards. We need to be outside. We don't know what the data, they say the data, I've talked to doctors who said the data of community spread outside is low, that this is just the state going too far. Now, if it's not, is it incumbent on the state to give a better rationale to avoid these kind of protests?
No one is more individual liberty oriented than I. It's heartbreaking that we have to resort to these measures. But in fact, the reality is this new third wave, which is impacting young people more so than the first, the original COVID. And we're noticing also that community spread is more widespread, even outside, even at 2 meters. So the data is still out. We're still trying to get a sense of it. But for sure, as we know now, the R-naught is higher, whether you're indoors or outdoors, which is why some of our measures include wearing the mask even outside, if you're going to be meeting people outside your bubble. But look, This is not a very good situation to be in. This is not an ideal situation. These are COVID times, and we have to adapt ourselves. And the and the curfew, according to our data, has been effective in reducing community spread.
So, I'll give you 10 seconds, Mr. Ski. So the curfew will remain. Is your government preparing for more protests and possibly more violence?
So, of course, our police are going to be standing by to make sure that, you know, disruptive things like that. And let's separate, you know, lawful protests from what happened yesterday. We're going to be ready. But at the same token, let's give another, you know, another push while we wait for vaccines to come into the community. Let's just hold together and try to get through this together.
All right. For those shopkeepers, we certainly hope there's no more vandalism. Mr. Skeet, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you for taking the time.
Anytime, Evan, and stay safe, everybody.
Yeah. All right. That's Christopher Skeet, M&A with the government. Good to have him on. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, why are the Liberals and the Bloc shutting down a committee that is trying to study sexual misconduct in the military? MPs are standing by. Stay with us. Welcome back to Power Play. We have some breaking news about the finance minister and a big announcement coming later tonight. Let me bring in the CTV News bureau chief in Ottawa, Joyce Napier, who's got the news. Joyce, what are we going to hear just after this program?
Well, exactly at 7 p.m. tonight, Chrystia Freeland, finance minister, will announce there is a bailout package for Air Canada. Now, we know that these negotiations between the government and Air Canada have been going on for a long time. We know very publicly that the airlines have asked the government again and again for some help. So we know that they will be an announcement. I don't know how many billions of dollars. I couldn't get that figure from them. But we know that it may be low interest loans, more wage subsidies to help those airlines and obviously make a deal with them so they would not be at the end of the year, for instance, fat bonuses for executives. Those never really look good for the public. Also, another little hurdle that they've had to negotiate with the airlines is when all these flights were canceled last year, there were $2.5 billion worth of trips of airline tickets that Canadians had bought and have never gotten reimbursed for. So obviously the $2.5 billion are included in this package. How will the airline reimburse people? It isn't clear yet. We will have details from the finance minister at 7 o'clock, but we do know that obviously it had to be part of this package. You can't take taxpayers' money and, you know, bail out the airline industry when that same airline industry owes taxpayers $2.5 billion in tickets that were never used. Because remember, last year, flights were canceled, reservations were canceled in hotels, a total worth of $2.5 billion that Air Canada owes its clients.
All right, Joyce Napier with the news here, saying that the federal government is set to announce a bailout package for Air Canada. This has been, as you say, in the making for a long time. We're going to find out the details, loans, some kind of wage subsidy. We're not sure if there's an equity element to this, as you say. They got to pay back those tickets and they can't bonus out the execs. We'll find out the details. Joyce Napier, okay. Joyce, if you get anything else, as you know, jump on the program at any
time. I'll
be back. We really appreciate the breaking news. All right, Joyce Napier with the breaking news. Thanks. We're going to pick that up later in the program. So that is coming. So the markets are closed and a bailout for the airlines as they're trying to get back on their feet. And as Joyce said, they owe Air Canada alone almost $2.5 billion in tickets to pay back to people who have missed their flights in the last year. In the meantime today, and I told you there was a lot going on, the Defense Committee's study into military sexual misconduct has suddenly stopped. The committee had been investigating allegations against the former defense chief, General Jonathan Vance. Allegations General Vance denies. But today, the Liberals and the Bloc Quebecois voted to end the study. All members will bring forward their final recommendations for their report by Friday, and then it's over. Does the committee need more time? And is partisanship standing in the way of change? MPs on that panel join that committee join us now. Karen McCrimmon is the chair of the National Defense Committee, as well as a veteran. James Bazana is the Conservative Party's defense critic, and Randall Garrison is the NDP's defense critic. Mr. McCrimmon, why did the Liberals on the Bloc vote to end the study when we don't know who's accountable, we don't know who knew what when? There seemed to be an enormous number of outstanding questions left for the public and, frankly, for people in the military. Why end the study now?
Because this should be about the survivors. This should be about the wants and needs of the survivors. And if you look at the advocacy groups for the survivors, they believe that a report is absolutely key. And that's how we're going to make measurable progress on this issue. Now, the nonpartisan clerk and analyst advised us that if we wanted to have a report out before the summer recess, this is the timeline we had to follow. So I think that getting a report is absolutely key. The advocates for the survivors believe the same thing, and that's why we're moving forward, so we get a report out that can be used as a roadmap to make the progress we need to make.
Let me just stick with you for a minute. What's the purpose of getting a report out quickly if you don't have all the information? Are you saying speed trumps? If there's more information to complete a more thorough report, isn't it better to wait?
I think on our committee alone, we have heard from 29 witnesses. 29 witnesses and 29 hours of testimony. We know what needs to get done. Those witnesses have given us their recommendations. What needs to change? Culture change, how we change how the military operates, how it's funded, how it responds to sexual trauma. We have those answers, the things that are going to make a direct and tangible impact on the lives of the men and women, women and men of the Canadian Forces, and the survivors of this kind of sexual trauma. It's up to us to move ahead now.
Mr. Bazan, what's your response to that?
Well, this is typical Liberals trying to continue on with their cover-up. They're hiding the truth, just like in the SNC-Lavalin scandal with the Weed scandal, when the opposition parties get too close to uncovering the truth and the Liberals are trying to hide something, they shut down investigations. You know, in all the years that I've been involved on the National Defense Committee, it's never taken us 2 months to write a report. We've always been able to put together substantive reports with solid recommendations to the government on how to move forward on any of these issues that we're dealing with, including sexual misconduct in the Canadian Armed Forces. But it is premature for the Liberals to shut down this study, Evan, when we still need to hear from key witnesses like Elder Marquis and Zita Estravis, who are both senior advisors in the Liberal upper echelon. Elder Marquis was an advisor right to Prime Minister Trudeau. And, of course, Zita Estravis was the chief of staff to Minister Sajjan. They knew stuff, and we still have yet to hear from them.
Okay, so Randall Garrison, the Liberals have, and I'll ask Ms. McCrimmon about that, but what, in your view, is left to get to know that might help the men and women in the military who have been assaulted or who are concerned about the future? In other words, I understand there's a political imperative of responsibility, but for this particular report, what else is needed?
Well, what's most important is trust in the system. And so when we had a case like this where accusations of sexual misconduct were made against the chief of defense staff, no one investigated. No one's taken responsibility for the fact that he stayed in office 3 years after these allegations. It's hard for anybody serving in the Canadian Forces to trust this system. So Liberals want to talk about what reforms need to be made, and frankly, so do we. That's the topic of the study going on in the Status of Women Committee. But what this study is about is why no one takes responsibility for the fact that someone accused of sexual misconduct was allowed to stay on as Chief of Defence Staff, was given a positive performance evaluation, which resulted in a pay raise, and was never investigated. What we would find out from the few remaining witnesses is what the Prime Minister knew and when he knew that. And then we can make an evaluation about who's really responsible, which minister should be taking responsibility for this failure to act on the accusations against the Chief of Defence Staff.
What just let me just stick with you for a minute. There's groups of volunteers who have worked with past and current military members who have said they experienced military trauma and they want a report now. So what do you tell those men and women who have worked in this, who are demanding that this comes out quickly? What is your response to them?
Well, I guess let me say, first of all, that I'm disappointed the Liberals would put victims and staff of the committee out in defense of their minister. And so what we really need to see is a resolution to this question of who's responsible so we can restore the trust. Then we can get on with the kind of reforms that are needed.
We just lost your video, Mr. Garrison. Just hang in there. We'll try to reestablish. Welcome to this kind of live television. Let me just go back. Karen McCrimmon, look, there are real questions about accountability. This is not, you know, as a veteran, there have been attempts before to deal with this that have dramatically failed. Now you've got two former chiefs of the defense staff who have been, who are facing serious accusations in this. This has reached the highest of the high levels. Why would there not be more attempt to get full transparency and full accountability before the report so that can actually be rectified? How can you fix something if you don't know how deeply it's broken?
You know what, Evan? I joined the Canadian Forces in 1975. So I have been at this for 45 years, waiting for change. It's time. And all of the survivors believe it's time. And delaying this report, now the clerk and their nonpartisan, the clerk's nonpartisan, the analysts are nonpartisan. They said, if you want a report, then this is what has to happen right now. Like, we've been studying this for 45 years. It's now time. This is our opportunity. But without a report, we're going to lose that opportunity, and survivors desperately don't want that to happen.
Okay, Mr. Garrison, we've lost his connection, but I'll just give you a quick last rebuttal there, Mr. Bazin.
Well, that's a terrible characterization, because over the last 45 years, we've dealt with some major things in the Canadian Armed Forces, and the culture hasn't changed yet. So this is our opportunity, and it takes all of the truth to come out to get to the bottom of exactly what happened, who knew what and when, and what was done with that information and what wasn't done with that information. And ultimately, this is about the women who serve in uniform and standing up for them, and it's unfortunate that the Liberals refuse to do that.
Okay, I'm going to leave it there. We're going to see where this goes. Mr. Garrison, I think we, I'm not sure about the connection, but I got to leave it there. Mr. Bazin, Mr. Garrison, and Ms. McCrimmon, great to have the three of you on a very vital subject. Thanks so much. We do have to take a break, but coming up, ICU admissions are hitting a scary level in places like Ontario. Schools are now shut down. Our in-school learning will be shut down in that province for a long time. Check this out.
I wish they would have announced the closure of schools weeks ago so parents could have planned, because I knew it was going to happen.
Okay, is the shutdown enough? We're going to have infectious disease specialist Dr. Abdu Sharkawi on next. Stay with us.
It's easy for people to sit back and say, should have, could have, would have, done this, done that. Walk a mile in someone's shoes, and then you'll find out, you'll wake up real quick, like you got hit over the head with a sledgehammer when you're on the call till midnight every single night, all day long, getting advice, and it's never the Premier or Doug Ford sitting in some corner making a decision. There's hundreds and hundreds of people that are part of every single decision that we make down here. So I listen. At the end of the day, I'll listen to the chief medical officer, and I'll never waver. I never have, and I never will waver.
Okay. I mean, yeah, leadership's tough, but, you know, open, closed, try to figure this one out. Look, the whole country's dealing with the third wave. Ontario hospitals, for example, because that's Doug Ford, the Premier of Ontario, are now ramping down elective surgeries, non-urgent activities. ICU admissions continue to climb. The province is reporting there are 619 patients in intensive care due to COVID-19-related illnesses. This is happening across the country. Last week, Chief Medical Officer Dr. Theresa Tam said patients in ICUs are up 23% from the previous week. And remember, back in February, the head of the science science advisory table in Ontario, Dr. Steiny Brown, said, yeah, we are predicting a disaster ahead, according to the modeling. And then certain provinces, including Ontario, kept opening up. On Sunday night, the education minister there sent a letter to parents saying, after the school break, schools will be open today. They had an about face. Now, how do you make sense of all this confusing data? Well, let's bring in the press gallery to find out. Tawny McCharles is the parliamentary reporter for the Toronto Star. She's here. Laura Stone is the Queen's Park reporter for the Globe and Mail. Our special guest is Dr. Abdur Sharkawi, our CTV News infectious disease specialist. Great to have you all on the program, Doc. Always thanks for your frontline work. I don't know, Doc, I'll just start with you because you heard the press conferences in the province where you live. You know, we didn't see this coming. We're trying to be proactive. Did the medical community see this dire situation coming in terms of ICUs and schools, and yet they still opened up? I just want your frontline view on that.
There's no question that the medical community has been very vocal and has raised concerns regarding the likelihood of not only variants of concern, but just the existing COVID-19 strains putting a real burden on our healthcare system. There's been increasing concern around transmission occurring within schools. Schools can't be permanently impervious to the effects of what's going on in the community. They can't be expected to be safe if no level of testing infrastructure has changed, if ventilation standards haven't improved, if class numbers haven't changed, if students are still eating lunch en masse together in groups of 25 and 30. None of these things have been addressed, and none of these things have frankly been addressed at any point during this pandemic. So it's frankly quite maddening to hear members of our government speak with such levels of confidence, saying that we didn't know that this was going to happen and that we've acted decisively. I would counter that you haven't acted decisively at all. You've acted only after the situation became extremely dire. It's about to get a lot worse. We're seeing patients all over the ICU in Kingston from Scarborough. I mean, for goodness sakes, what does that tell you about the state of our healthcare system? It's unacceptable. And we have to hold the government to account to make some tangible changes here in terms of their policy making and in terms of responding to the medical community more expediently, not after the fact, not after things have reached this level of calamity here.
You were, Laura Stone, you were there. You were questioning the premier and the health minister today, and the education minister, rather, about this. What do you make of the fact that Sunday night, and I know Tonda's got kids in the school system as well, school was on, in-school learning, now it's off. They said, oh, we're just responding. What do you make of the flip-flop and what's going on here? Because, it's a bit of a head spinner.
It is, Evan. And you know, these decisions aren't easy, and schools are clearly a point of pride for this government. They don't want to close them because it's a mark in some way of failure that they've failed to keep them safe, that they've failed to stem off the rising tide of variants and ICUs. And, you know, quite frankly, no one wants them to close. No one wants kids to have to be at home. And it does disadvantage lower income children, for instance. Not everyone has two or three laptops sitting around for at home learning. But to say that they acted proactively is just alternative facts. The education minister was out penning an open letter to parents last night saying schools will stay open during the stay-at-home order. Now, to pretend that they didn't write that or that they didn't see this coming, it really does not shine a very good light on this government's ability to see ahead. And they are in reactive mode. They seem to constantly be changing their minds about whether they're opening or closing. And in the end, it really does hurt the public's confidence in this government and the government's decision-making process.
Yeah, look, we've seen reactions, Tawny. Yeah, go ahead, Tawny, because we've seen reactions in other provinces.
Yeah.
Like Quebec, they've had the protests, and in Alberta, there's been some protests. But go ahead, because confusing messaging is something we've talked about a lot.
Yeah, it's across the country in many jurisdictions, actually. And, Laura's perfectly captured it in saying that the Ford government is being reactive. Actually, there are several governments that are being reactive. And the irony is we hear the general public, we watch the sessions where provincial experts on modeling and predicting just what's going to happen come out and say exactly what's going to happen. And guess what? We're there in many cases. But I think what you're finding as a result of these reactive protective postures by governments is really not just pandemic weary people across the country, but you also see this now rising or very concerning, shall we say, concern around vaccine and vaccine confidence. You know, just today, one of the big polling companies in Canada, Angus Reid, came out with some really interesting numbers of showing that, you know, yes, about 70% of us still want to get a vaccine. But you know what? Very nervous about AstraZeneca. Think that the and actually there's fully about 20% of Canadians actually think the government is inflating the COVID case numbers. That's astonishing to me this far in. So it calls for clarity on the part of all governments and all medical experts in this case to really persuade Canadians, because clearly they're not persuaded.
Yeah, I'll give you the last word on this, Dr. Sharkawi. You know, I kind of wish everyone could just take a peek into what you're seeing every day in the ICU and who's in there, how real and how urgent it is. But I don't think it helps when people are riding the yo-yo of up and down and up and down. I get it. It's difficult. Businesses are suffering. There's a lot of concerns here, but that does not mitigate the need for clarity and transparency.
There's no question about it. We are facing a monumental crisis in trust in this country when it comes to public health messaging, when it comes to ensuring that Canadians understand not only the risks of COVID-19, but the relative risks and overwhelming benefits of vaccines that are here to protect us. I think we all need to recognize that we are, no question, facing a more serious crisis now with the variants of concern and a susceptible population that did not exist in the first wave of this pandemic, and not so much in the second wave, but it's very much here. It's young people, so young people who are going to die or who are going to suffer irreparable consequences. We can't be happy letting that happen. This is unacceptable.
Dr. Sharkawi, all right, I really appreciate you joining us. Laura Stone and Tanya McCharles are going to stick with us. We're going to take a break. Lots ahead, including breaking news. The Liberal government is about to announce a multi-billion-dollar bailout for Air Canada. This in the wake of the dueling conventions for the NDP and the Liberals. But this breaking news may change that and give a hint of what's coming in the budget. We'll talk about all that and lots more coming up. Stay with us. So we broke the news just earlier on the program. At 7 p.m. Eastern time tonight, Chrystia Freeland, the finance minister, is going to announce a multi-billion dollar airline bailout package to Air Canada. We'll find out what the situation for WestJet and other airlines is going to be. We understand it will include some kind of loan situation. It will be contingent on Air Canada paying back passengers who have held tickets. We'll find out if there's going to be a caveat that you can't bonus out executives because people don't like that. And what this means, will they take an ownership stake or not, as they did, remember, during the auto bailout. Let's bring back the press gallery. Tonda McCharles from the Toronto Star is here, and Laura Stone from the Globe and Mail is here. Tonda, this has been a long time in the making. What do we know now? And maybe more as importantly, what are the politics of the timing on this?
Well, the politics of the timing are really interesting because the federal government has been rolling out a lot of big things prior to next week's budget. And this is a huge one. One would have expected this to be rolled out in the budget. But look, if it is as billed, what we're hearing is, you know, some of our colleagues are reporting there will be no equity stake by the government in the airlines, but they're seeking to protect jobs in every way possible by the way of providing a wage subsidy and, I guess, protecting, you know, things like aircraft orders and whatnot. But I think that, let's face it, this has been a package in the negotiation process for months and months right now. To announce it today, previously, about 2 weeks ago or so, the federal government rolled out $7 billion for healthcare for the provinces. Again, you know, teased out before the budget. We had very clear indications from the convention about a big child care package coming. So it's very clear to me that this government, though they don't talk about election, is putting themselves in every way, shape and form to be ready in case their budget doesn't pass. Now, who's going to vote against that? Who's going to vote against childcare? Who's going to vote against an airline bailout? They're not going to call it a bailout, but it's a bailout. Who's going to vote against health money for the provinces? Let's face it, nobody. But the Liberals are going to basically have something to crow about for months going forward.
So 7 p.m. tonight, I'm just getting more notes here. 7 p.m., Chrystia Freeland and Omar Al-Gabra, obviously the transport minister, are going to make an announcement in the next half an hour. There's going to be something called notification from Air Canada, which means they have to follow a certain process to get these things. Laura Stone, what do you make of what we may see? And again, as Tana talked about, you know, the secret to politics is timing.
Well, obviously the Liberal government wants to remind people who's in charge. And we saw that over the weekend at the conference with Prime Minister Trudeau, basically talking about all the measures that the Liberal government has instituted throughout the pandemic. This is obviously going to be a very consumer-friendly announcement, especially if people will get refunds back from the airline that they haven't been able to access for the past year. It's also probably a union-friendly announcement as well, so trying to eat some of the NDP's lunch there. But obviously, as Tonda talked about, the Liberals are gearing up here to have all their ducks in a row, to tie it with a little bow, to say that, you know, they aptly managed the pandemic. They want to get people their money back. You know, these are the measures that they're putting in place. And so I really do think this is as pre-election as it gets. You know, whether an election is held in June or October, I think the Liberals are clearly gearing up for that.
Yeah, these are expensive ducks. So we're going to find out 7 p.m. So just over an hour from now, we'll find out the details of that bailout. As both Tonda and Laura are saying, this will not be the only bailout. We'll have to find out what small airlines and WestJet, other major airlines, are getting in. But boy, there's a lot going on as we lead up to that April 19th federal budget. Tonda and Laura, just awesome to have the both of you on top of all this stuff. Thanks so much for joining us on the Press Gallery. That is all the time we've got, but stay right here on CTV News Channel. That announcement is coming soon. We'll be back here in 23 short hours. Hug your loved ones if it's safe. Thanks for watching. Have a great evening.